Hello, everyone. Okay. There are so many options when we're investing and putting together and constructing portfolios. Why would we look at residential? That's something we're going to explore today. Residential in and of itself is the largest asset class in Australia. It's historically delivered attractive returns at reduced risk. The fundamentals are good for the sector going forward. And until now, there's been limited managed access. So this session will look at the attractiveness of the fundamentals. We're going to explore how a residential property portfolio can add value within a well-diversified portfolio. And then we're also going to conclude with a new approach to accessing this attractive asset class via a managed fund. We're going to cover 9 facts today that each build to building the case for residential within a well-diversified portfolio. They are size, inflation-hedged investment returns, favorable risk and return trade-off, negative returns less likely, low correlation, largely independent performance, the fact that an inefficient market creates opportunities, compelling fundamentals going forward. We'll have a look at the ASX Residential Property Index, which is coming, and we'll also have a quick look at tax effectiveness. We're going to cover off each one of these 9 one at a time. So the first point to make is that residential property is the largest asset class in Australia. As of July, residential property sector was $3.2 trillion, as compared with commercial property at $0.4 trillion, shares at $1 trillion, and fixed interest at $2 trillion. Another thing to point out is that residential property is 70% owner-occupier. These are people that live in their own homes. And also that 95% of residential property is owned by individuals. This is a key underlying reason why the market is inefficient and why there are particular opportunities in this sector. We'll come back to this in more detail. Fact number 2 is inflation-hedged investment returns. The orange dotted line there is at 2.95%. That's inflation over the last 20-year period. All of the analysis on here has been done 20 years to March 09, which was the latest time period that was available at the time this white paper was put together. Residential property over this time period returns 9.2% after all fees and costs. And that includes transaction costs and management costs as well. Second only to retail property and fixed interest over this period. Okay, what this chart shows is return and volatility. So we've got return on the y-axis here, going from 0 to 12, and volatility going from 0 to 16. So for the 20 years to March 2009, what we can see is that residential property delivered higher than average returns after all fees and costs than a number of asset classes, and also less volatility. So it's on average, it's lower volatility and higher returns. And it's these characteristics that we'll explore in the next few slides and the impact of that when you add it to a well-diversified portfolio. Okay. One of the things to point out is that the probability of a negative return over a rolling 4-quarter period is minimal. 2.5%, in fact. So this is looking at this means that there are actually only 2 rolling 4 quarters over 80 quarters over the last 20 years that actually had a negative return. Okay. If you've been keeping an eye on residential house prices, you would have seen that they've been extraordinarily resilient over this past period, particularly the past 18 months, when a number of asset classes have not fared as well. So the 2.5% compares with Australian shares at 22.5% of rolling 4-quarter periods are negative, have been negative in the past 20 years. Overseas shares, 30% of the rolling 4-quarter periods over the last 20 years. Okay, residential property, the blue band here is showing the correlation and comparing it to other asset classes. So residential property actually exhibits a particularly low correlation or even slightly negative correlation with most other asset classes. So as compared, starting at the left-hand side, as compared to Australian shares, it's got a correlation of 0.14. Negative 0.01 with overseas shares, 0.16 in listed property, 0.29 in direct property, which is the strongest correlation, but still not that strong, negative 0.23 with Australian fixed interest, overseas fixed interest at negative 0.21, and cash at negative 0.26. So this shows that including residential property provides broad diversification benefits when we're including it within a well-diversified portfolio with the other asset classes. Fact number six is that an inefficient market creates opportunities. We pointed out before that 95% of properties are owned by individuals. Most of these individuals are amateurs, if you think about it from a trading perspective. Most individuals that own property will only transact a few times in their lives. We wouldn't expect them to be expert at what they're doing. And as a result, that's one opportunity and source of inefficiency. So the sector is highly fragmented. It's controlled by individuals and amateurs. The reason why corporate money to date hasn't actually flown and doesn't own a larger percentage of this segment is because to actually get any meaningful share in there, they would need to own a lot of individual assets, houses, and units. And most organizations that have looked at this in the past have not wanted to deal with the level of management that would be required to manage that portfolio. Another thing that makes the market inefficient is the lack of pricing transparency. There are virtually no identical assets in Australian property, and valuing assets can be tricky in a number of other property sectors as well, but residential is no exception. So another point around individuals only transacting a few times in their lives, many of them are not going to be that skilled at research, analysis, selection, negotiation, and finance. Emotion is commonplace when transacting residential assets. People often, even in the investment space outside of their own home, tend to get quite attached and often don't make purely objective investment decisions, let alone the proper due diligence that should go into leveraging into a significant asset. Life events can also result in forced sales, which can result in compromised outcomes. You've got death, divorce, and financial hardship. There's a whole number of opportunities that we see all of the time in the marketplace where if you've got relationships with agents, et cetera, that you can take advantage of. And this is a source of inefficiency. And it's professional property buyers that have the advantage of information such as off-market sales or even vendor situations. So some of the information that would be deemed insider trading in the stock market is not insider trading in property, and again, relationships can get behind some of that information and can be used to the advantage in negotiating. Okay, let's talk about the fundamentals for residential going forward. We already touched briefly on the resilience of this sector. The sector has taken a breather. It's taken a significant breather since about 2003, and has come back over that time period, but is just starting to tick up again. Really, one of the major reason why Australia is different from what we've seen overseas, and I'm sure a number of you have seen some of the articles published by the IMF raising alarm bells, saying that Australian property is overpriced, et cetera, and it's going to go the way of the UK and Ireland and whatnot. There are a number of dynamics at play here, and it's not just the income to price ratios or the debt service ratios that they're actually quoting. One of the main things that the IMF analysis that is often quoted and we think often blown out of proportion in the media is the fact that they actually didn't take into consideration supply and demand. So they did not take into account the fact that there was already a structural shortage of supply in the Australian market. What this chart shows is completions and underlying demand, and then the blue bars are actually the cumulative situation. Okay, and what we can see are record shortages of residential housing as completions drop off and underlying demand continues to increase. On the demand side, and the reason for the completions being down significantly is mainly because you've got developer economics which aren't stacking up fantastically at the moment, but look to be improving a bit. And there's just a great deal of uncertainty, as there are in a number of the different markets. So it's caused a bit of paralysis. But the result is it's actually exacerbating the supply situation. The demand side is quite compelling as well. You actually look at Australia as a country of immigrants. I always find this statistic quite extraordinary. Last year was the highest percentage growth in population in 40 years. We've got a huge number of net immigrants from overseas. We've also got the birth rate is also ticking up. And on top of that, you also have a number of demographic factors at play. You've got the average size of household is actually shrinking substantially. And that creates the need for additional dwellings as well, which isn't captured in net population growth. That's actually in addition to it. Okay, and obviously, we've got historically low interest rates. All of these things are leading to that and a combination of people being a bit weary with the investments that they've had and significant losses. Many of them have been in cash, and we're starting to see cash flow back into the resi sector in a fairly modest way. Okay. Fact number 8, the ASX Residential Property Index. So we believe that resi should be taken more seriously as an asset class in its own right when constructing portfolios. The ASX does as well. They've recognized the importance of this sector. They've recently announced in the past year or so the intention to develop a derivatives product to provide exposure to the housing index. Okay, they're going to promote the asset class in its own right, and in fact, they're doing that quite actively, going around to a number of the fund managers and trying to convince them that they should have a box for resi when they're allocating, when they're constructing their portfolios. Yes. Yes. Yes, you can. Which is, I might just jump to the last point there. We're actually looking forward to it as a potential hedging tool. So that'd be quite useful, actually. So we believe the index approach has merit. We're very pleased to see that they're actually out there pushing resi as its own sector, and as we've been pushing it for some time now. But we also believe that an active approach has the capacity to deliver above index returns, as we can use. A professional manager can go and cherry pick particular assets, or even individuals if they knew what they were doing and did their good and did proper due diligence and negotiated well, they can cherry pick assets and do better than the index. Okay, tax effectiveness. So investors in a residential property managed fund can accrue similar benefits as DIY investors. We've received professional tax advice actually from the auditor of the fund, HLB Manjud, that effectively investors will effectively get all of the same benefits on a flow-through basis. Okay, and that comes down to cash items, interest, borrowing costs, repairs rates, and agent fees. Non-cash items, capital allowances, and net losses, which are carried forward and offset against future income and capital gains. We've also received advice from Deakins that unit holders can negatively gear into the fund similar to DIY investors. I understand that it's something that should not be taken lightly, people gearing into a geared fund. However, the opportunity does exist, and they can negatively gear into the fund. At the moment, the fund is 38%. Okay. Just shifting gears to portfolio construction, looking at asset allocation benefits, there are three key issues for investors in this asset class. One is the concept of owning your own home versus an allocation in a diversified portfolio. This is something Monique and Richard Wakeland, she's a very well-known commentator in the segment, in the sector, said Australians already own too much property, the plaintive refrain of the uninformed. One of the issues is that if you think about the house you live in, you don't receive rent, you don't get the tax, you don't get tax benefits, and often the house that you actually live in has not been selected with investment criteria in mind. Growth or yield, this is something that comes up quite frequently. Most of the other property funds in the market are yield-based. We have a total returns focus, and on balance, it will be more capital growth than it will be yield. That's the nature of residential. Residential does not throw off high yield. So historically, rental income has not been a key reason to invest in resi property. Resi property also has a number of ongoing expenses, and it dictates that through the power of compounded growth, you should really have a growth focus. If you look back at the last 20 years and looked at cash flow properties versus looking at capital growth, and you look at the compounded growth, where the cash flow properties, you're having to pay tax on that as you go, and it doesn't compound, it just doesn't stack up. So it's really, resi is really a growth product. Okay, let's have a look at the impact of including resi in a diversified portfolio. Okay, what this chart shows, I'll just orient it for you. So on the y-axis here, you've got return going from 7.5% to 10%, and you've got volatility going from 7.5% to 4%. What this chart shows is the impact of adding residential property holdings to a diversified portfolio at 0%, 5%, 10% allocation to the portfolio, 15, going all the way up to, it shows that you going up to about 40-45%, increasing resi within a diversified portfolio to 40-45%, both reduces volatility and increases return. This is, of course, historical data. This is the last 20 years. Using the same data in a slightly different way, one way to think about it, we previously looked at the chance of a negative return, and we saw that there were only two quarters out of 80 that produced, two rolling four quarters out of 80 that produced negative returns. As you increase residential property exposure from zero up towards 40-45 within a diversified portfolio, you reduce the probability of a negative annual return in the portfolio. And we've just picked a number here. So we picked out one of the data points, which says a 10% allocation to resi can reduce the chance of a negative return to 10% from what was closer to 14%. So that's resi as an asset class. We'd like to shift gears and start to segue into introducing the idea of resi through a managed product. Okay, so access to this asset class, fund managers versus DIY. When an individual goes to buy residential property, it's got a number of consequences for investors. One is they've got to come up with the upfront capital, which includes the debt as well, and they have to service that debt. There are also administrative burdens of managing residential property. If any of you have a sizable portfolio, or even three or four, you'd know that it actually takes a bit of time, even if you have somebody else managing it. You've still got to deal with tenant issues. It's not set and forget. Also, the fact that few individual investors achieve portfolio diversification, the vast number of property investors only have one or two properties. And often the properties tend to be very close to where they live, because that's the area they know, and it certainly provides no geographic diversification when they go down that path. Okay. Professional fund managers in this sector can offer a disciplined and unemotional approach. They can use professional search tools and techniques beyond the skill of the average investor, or probably the will of the average investor as well. A fund manager should be able to achieve diversification well beyond the reach of most investors. And the fund manager also has an opportunity to maintain modest gearing levels, in the sense that many investors will gear 70-80% or higher just to get into property, and there are plenty of 90-95% loans around, although 95% is a little bit harder to get these days, but it's quite normal for people to leverage into these assets, which of course can concentrate their risk substantially. The fund, by contrast, has access to more resources and does not necessarily need to gear up as high. One additional point on that is that a fund would have the ability to re-leverage faster than an individual investor. So an individual investor might have to wait for their property to increase in value by 20-30% so that they can refinance the property and actually pull out the equity. If a fund's got 10 properties and the portfolio goes up by 5%, depending on the finance instrument they're using for the debt, they can likely re-leverage much quicker to keep that money active. Fund manager can also focus on creating, or professional buyer can focus on creating an initial risk buffer by acquiring assets below market value, and this could be an actual valuation, or it could even be acquiring something with an insight that the average investor didn't have in terms of where you can add value to the asset. And then there's the opportunity for active ongoing management of the portfolio, which again could be adding value to the asset through renovations, et cetera, and also actively managing the portfolio and rebalancing as the state cycles move, as most of the states move in different cycles. You can take advantage of that. Okay. Just very quickly, the Ironstone Residential Fund was set up with the investment thesis for the fund was very simply that a professional, more sophisticated approach that's systematic, applying it to a sector that's effectively DIY and amateurs in their experience in terms of transacting, should create the opportunity to outperform on a consistent basis and over the long term. Okay. So we aim to provide investors with geared exposure to the residential property market with the aim of outperforming the major residential property markets over the long term. Our target is to return 3% over the ABS index, net of all fees and costs, over the long term. Our investment style is very conservative in terms of where we're actually buying, how we're buying in terms of the acquisition criteria, the acquisition selection, our gearing, we have a very conservative gearing policy, valuations, we get valuations when we buy, and we have an active management overlay. We believe that you need that in the next 10 to 15 years, people are going to need to roll up their sleeves and actively add value to residential assets to get the kind of performance that they would hope that they would be looking for, and possibly to match what we've seen in the past. Our investment strategy is to buy quality houses and units with the potential for high growth yield and the opportunity to add value and hold for the long term. In terms of where we're actually investing, greater than 75% of our assets will be within a 10-kilometer ring of Australian capital cities. The main reason for this is because we actually want to buy where there's already significant scarcity. Okay? That actually limits the downside and it limits the volatility. And buying in highly desirable areas that were built out first for a reason and will continue to be the most desirable places to live creates steady demand for those suburbs. And there's no opportunity for a big development to increase capacity next door if there's no more land. Okay, our benchmark is the official ABS House Price Index, which is released quarterly. Our gearing policy, we have a targeted long-term gearing level of 65%. We actively manage this through the cycle. Our choice of gearing is primarily based on what we think the impact will be on the unit price, but it obviously also takes into consideration the appetite for the market in terms of risk at the time. And we have an indirect cost ratio of 1.75%. Sure. It could be 24 months from now. Market heats up, seeing 15% returns, and it seems like a responsible environment to be moving to those levels. It wouldn't necessarily stay at those levels. We'd be monitoring it very actively. It may or may not. It may or may not. It depends on one of our assets for the moment. We've bought is just over 2% yield. We're actually renovating the house, and we'll be getting a 6% yield on that. So, on average, I think when you add in the management fees and the costs and the cost of the debt, it may not. So in that case, we'll actually be operating at a loss. Very similar on an income basis, which is exactly the same thing as negative gearing. I mean, obviously, it's fundamentally dependent on what the interest rate is. that we maintain a cash buffer equivalent to at least 1x interest cover at a 2% interest rate shock. Liquidity for units in the fund. Sorry, who asked the question? Is that the question? Yeah. We've moved to 3-year rolling redemptions. We actually started the fund on 90 days, and over the past year, we've received strong input from the advisor community and from dealer groups that they'd actually like us to make it less liquid. And the reason being is they want people to think very, very carefully about putting their money into this. They want it to be a better reflection of the underlying asset class, which frankly we think it is. So we actually operate on a rolling 3-year redemption basis. We did have 90 days, and we had an exit fee in the first 5 years because we wanted people not to think about this as a short-term investment. So it was a bit of a slap on the wrist. It was 4%. It wasn't prohibitive. It was just think about it. But when we've moved to the rolling 3-year redemptions, we've removed the exit fee. Our ability to change it. To make it less liquid. To make it less liquid. Our ability, we would have to go back and change. It would be a big deal. We would need to get approval from unit holders, for one. We would also need to give everyone the opportunity to redeem, if that was the case. If we were going to significantly change the liquidity profile and make it a longer period of time, as goes with, frankly, most of the features of the fund and the key metrics, we would give people the opportunity to redeem. Yes, we did. Yes, we did. We had to pass the unit holder resolution. Yes. Mm-hmm. Sure. We're a value fund, but the number one criteria for selecting assets is the capital growth profile. Okay. Yield is a secondary consideration. We also look at the ability to add value to the asset. That's very important to us to be able to manufacture some equity, which effectively creates a risk buffer in the asset. Okay, it lowers the effective asset acquisition price. Yes. Yeah. Sure. No. Thank you for the question, because I haven't covered it in the text here. That's right. So we have a boutique focus. Okay. Boutique meaning that we're actually looking at individual assets. We like to think of it as actually a sniping fund. Okay. A cherry picking or sniping fund, as we're going after the best assets, which are, again, we're looking at capital growth, ability to add value. And as far as where we're actually buying in terms of the dollar range, our investment strategy is to buy in higher than average median suburbs in the city, so effectively inside 10Ks, but to buy in the value range of the premium suburbs. We actually believe that provides plenty of scope, particularly when we've added value. We're not too far over the median, if at all, so we've created value, and we're still in a value segment of a premium suburb. And we're buying highly desirable suburbs. We've got a house in Double Bay and a waterfront unit in Tamarama. These areas will likely always be in steady demand. It's an important consideration, yes. But it will range. It could range from a lick of paint to doing significant alterations and additions to a house. Sure. We're focusing on boutique. We're not interested in acquiring a large tract of land. Frankly, particularly in the areas we're looking, we're not going to find any large tracts of land. But we would be interested, say, in acquiring a house on a large block in the southeast suburbs of Melbourne, in Elwood or Brighton. House on a large block that we can actually replace over time with two or three townhouses on it. So very boutique in size development. But I'll make it very clear that one of the things that we do not do development. Okay, development, one of the key characteristics of development, one of the most dangerous aspects of traditional development is the fact that a large part of the risk is actually the requirement to sell on completion or to actually get the money in time. Because we have a buy, add, value, hold strategy, we've actually taken that risk out of play. So if for some reason on completion we actually don't have, it's not a favorable market to sell, our intention is not to sell anyway, but we're effectively renting it out. It's a very good question. I actually don't know how you would strip it out of the index, to be honest. It actually is built. It is inbuilt to the index, and so on balance, it actually hurts us comparably because we clearly have to factor in the cost of actually our refurbishments. But you're right. Money spent, if people have spent 1 or 2% of the index to increase its value by 3, that's actually that is actually in the index. My understanding.
Manager offer, this type of investment, obviously you can do it yourself. You don't have the time looking for a classification so I think we'll create a buyer. Lastly, position the portfolio. Poll I've done today is the interest. I think you could wait for portfolios. Number one would be direct cost. Number two would be infrastructure. Three would be the property trust.
Yes.
One of the charts you had earlier was
I think that was the cumulative. I'll go back to it. You basically got the gap widening. You are starting to see the blue bit is a cumulative shortage based on what's happening here. So this gets added to this. Yeah. Sorry, it's a bit of a busy chart. Yes. Mm-hmm. Surprisingly, I don't have the chart with me, but if you actually look at interest rates, going back in time and look at house price growth and the purchase levels of residential property, I think it was back around 1990 when we had very, very high interest rates, 16, 17, 18%, you actually found that residential prices and demand kept driving through that period. One of the nice things about buying property is the fact that you're actually generally buying it with depreciating assets. You're buying it with debt that stays the same in an inflationary environment, and as housing usually rides on top of the inflation, you tend to do a bit better actually. Sorry, when you say 7.5 times earnings, you're talking about the average individual's income? Okay. Yeah, that was the IMF's argument. Okay. Yeah, there are a couple of things to point out. One is that they didn't take into account the fundamental demand and supply, particularly the supply. We've got net actually, let me back up a bit. I'm not sure the residential prices across the board in all geographic areas are going to do fantastic. The reason we're actually focusing on inside of 10Ks, because those are the areas that there's been a trend towards urbanization, people moving in. They tend to be very desirable suburbs. And because of the continued population pressure on that, you're seeing somehow an ability of people to continue to pay more. Now, a couple of things around the debt service ratio, which is born out of what you're saying there. Australia did shoot up to 21% in the debt service ratio, which was actually above the U.S.'s highest figure of 15% or so. That has now come back with the reduction in interest rates, back much closer to the U.S.'s figure. One other key point, there was one analysis that was done by Ian Huntley a few months ago, actually looked at the equity debt ratios of Australian households versus other households. You look at the U.S., the average U.S. household has 45% equity and 55% debt. In Australia, it's 80% equity and 20% debt. So they're in a fundamental different balance sheet position. And also the fact that you have new coffers of money opening up. Super rules have relaxed. Super is obviously a very large pot of money. And over recent years, that's been relaxed and is now that's starting to trickle into residential property. And my understanding is in the Henry report, they're even considering opening that up to primary residences, which would really open the floodgates with super money. So I think there's potentially a balance sheet aspect to that as well. I'm not going to argue that at some point there is elasticity. That's definitely going to be the case. There certainly are some people doing that. One of the answers to your question is the fact that people are actually willing to. There's more share accommodation happening, and actually shared ownership, which is another reason why people can actually afford more to be in the areas they want to live in. I mean, it still doesn't. We still need places to put people, and we've got record net population growth. So, but I agree with your point. At some point, there would be some elasticity. Yeah. Sorry. Yes. I think I touched on a few of the points in the last two questions that were raised. I guess what I'm pointing out is that there's a fundamental imbalance in demand and supply, and there's no question that's having an increased effect on prices. House prices are now currently better value than they were 5-6 years ago. So given that the market's taking a breather, so I agree with you that the ratio can't go forever, but people always find a way to pay more and more for things over time. We always have. And you know, I think if you look back at house prices, people raise this every 5 to 10 years. People raise this on an ongoing basis. Oh, they can't double, and people find a way, either through productivity or sharing accommodation or finding alternative sources of assets, whether it be super or any other help the government might provide. The government's also very keen on you can see stimulus after stimulus. They do not want house prices to drop, as you can see from what they roll out time and time again. Sorry, that's not going to do any questions. Yes? Sure. At the moment, the fund, as Edwina pointed out, we've been running for 18 months. We have two assets in the fund. Okay, we've got a house in Double Bay, and we have a waterfront unit in Tamarama. We would like to, have had a few more properties at this stage, but having been a startup manager in this time, it's been a bit challenging raising money. From a performance perspective, though, what we had here at the last chart is simply a continuation of what all of our core investment professionals have been doing in their own right. So our core investment professionals have actually achieved over 30% higher capital growth in the market over the life of the entire portfolio, which is substantial. This analysis has not been done over a longer period than 20 years. That's the short answer. Although if you look at residential property prices going back, it's a fantastic chart. It basically looks back 100 years, and it looks back through all the wars and all of the massive global crises we've had. And resi prices may flatten out for a while, but they flatten out and they continue to go up. So I don't know what this would look like over 100 years. But there haven't been any major drops in residential property prices. The answer is yes, we have. We don't think there's any chance of that happening, to be honest. But another slide we didn't have in here is why is Australia different? So just to cover off on that quickly, okay, is that Australia had a fundamental shortage of housing to start with, okay? We've got record population growth. We've got demographics with household sizes shrinking, so you're increasing that. And a couple of other things, the U.S. also went a bit crazy with the subprime loans. As you're aware, the Australian banks were much more conservative. And in the U.S., the loans were also non-recourse. So people could just hand in their keys and say, thank you, which people are quite hesitant to do in this country. So there's a lot. I mean, in order to get a 30% drop, World War III aside, and major shocks, if we're talking about relative business as usual and the things we've been talking about at the conference, one of the key things that we look to do, as I said, is acquire assets below effective market value, which includes the ability to add value through say a renovation, and we're hoping to say create, this is what I talk about, this initial risk buffer, and creating that so that it's say 15% on average of an initial risk buffer, which means if the market moved backwards 10%, that you would be okay. One of the things I might just point out here is that over this time frame, the assets in this portfolio, in our portfolio, went backwards in value. Okay, which I think is a twist on answering your question, because the market actually went backwards. But we, for valuations, it gets to both of the things. Where we knew we were buying well, we knew we were buying below market value. We got a professional independent val before we marked to market. Okay, we did that twice on the two properties, and the additional value created is actually from adding off-street parking to a double bay house that didn't have parking. Very, very, very simple. And we have a main DA in on that to just replace the original three-bedroom brick cottage with a four-bedroom executive residence. Pretty straightforward. And what's in that? And we expect that there's the equivalent of at least 400, maybe $500,000 in net value created just by rebuilding the house. And we'll only forego about $60,000 in rent for that. On net assets of 1.5. So on that basis, obviously, the significant scope, if we didn't add any other assets to the portfolio, to perform very well over the next 12 to 18 months as we just rebuild that. And that's, of course, this is a microcosm, because we'd like to raise more money, of what we'd like to do when we just scale up the fund, just doing more of this. Yes? Yes. Thank you for the question. Yes, there is. We will not manage properties directly, as in managing tenants from inside the fund. We have a manager principle. Now, we actually don't think that's where a lot of the value is added. That's not where we want to be spending our core investment professionals' time. So we have a panel at the moment. We will extend that panel when we go to other cities, in terms of top property managers in the area, to manage the day to day. Sorry? Yeah. I've got a multi-state portfolio that includes houses, units, and apartments. Our team collectively has got 15 properties across several states. That is our experience, and that's where we've effectively focused on bringing private equity quality due diligence into the residential sector. It's creating these opportunities.